If you don't get enough sleep, you're not only hurting yourself, you could be hurting your future children. This is one of the revelations in some of the latest research on sleep deprivation.
Gemma Tarlak is with us to talk about that story and more from the world of science. She's senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about science. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, it's always great to be here.
So this was kind of a scary article about sleep. I've had a bit of insomnia lately, and now I'm even more freaked out about it. But it turns out sleep is really, really important for all kinds of reasons.
It is, and I have to tell you, this was just the most depressing story for me to edit because it came in beautifully read and everything, but I'm a lifelong insomniac, and so reading the story about all the horrible things I'm doing to myself because I don't sleep just made me so sad. So, I mean, not sleeping is such a big deal for a big reason, and it's also affecting a huge number of Americans, at least 70 million, who have sleeping disorders of a variety. And basically, sleep is when your brain, let's start there, house cleans and gets rid of all the junk it doesn't need, gets rid of the clutter, you know, kind of organizes your closet, if you want to look at it that way, so that the next time you need something from your closet, it's much easier to access. And if you don't sleep, boom, your brain doesn't ever get around to doing the nice decluttering, and it causes so many problems just with the brain, but outside the brain, oh my gosh. So it puts you at risk for all kinds of things, such as a higher risk of metabolic disorders, higher risk of cardiovascular problems. Even, you know, children who have sleep apnea are at a higher risk of having trouble learning in school. It hits you in all different ways.
One of the most surprising things to me, at least reading about this, is it can actually affect us, I guess, on the genetic level. So problems we pick up from not sleeping can be passed on genetically to our kids?
Yeah, well, it actually does not change the DNA. I want to make that clear.
Okay.
But if you've been following epigenetics, it's a huge, very hot field in science now. And people are realizing that there are all these other changes, kind of, if you think of them as chemical reactions around your DNA, that kind of flip the on-off switch of your individual genes. It's called epigenetics, and some things like DNA methylation, it's a big word, but it basically involves flipping an off switch when it should be on or flipping an on switch when it should be off for that particular gene. And that can really affect susceptibility to a variety of conditions. And they're finding that epigenetic changes can be passed down through, you know, future generations, much the way you pass your genes down. But it's not actually changing the DNA.
Mm.
It's an interesting profile you begin with, too. A radiologist whose life was pretty much falling apart because he discovered he wasn't sleeping well, and it took him a long time to unravel it. But it makes you wonder about how much your present conditions might have to do with sleep.
Absolutely. And you know, Joe Borelli, who is the radiologist that we follow in the story, he was on the top of his game. He had two practices. He was an assistant professor. And everything just kind of fell apart to the point that he was worried he had early onset Alzheimer's. It was, you know, that debilitating to his entire life. Unfortunately, he got diagnosed with a slightly less common than apnea disorder called upper airway resistance syndrome. And once he was diagnosed, he was able to really rebuild his life, and he did that through getting a good night's sleep. So it's amazing all the different ways sleep can affect us.
So you've had insomnia yourself. We're talking about when we have sleep problems.
Yeah.
Reading all this stuff makes me stressed out about not sleeping. That's not going to help anybody sleep.
It keeps me up at night.
How are we doing in the world of science and medicine at tackling these sleep problems so people get the sleep they need?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And part of the equation is, yes, you may have a sleep disorder like apnea, but there's another part of it, too, that, come on, do you check your phone before you go to sleep? Do you even turn your phone off? Are you watching TV late into the night? You know, we're kind of in this 24/7 culture, and so you may just culturally be giving yourself a sleep disorder by, you know, checking your email or what have you in the middle of the night. So that's one area that we can fix without any kind of medication. Think of it as maybe behavior modification instead. But they are making terrific advances. In fact, in our June issue, we're going to have, actually our July issue, we're going to have a great story about a new way of helping us fall asleep.
Well, we're going to move on to a groundbreaking story about human evolution centered on a site called Dmanisi. Now, first of all, where is that site?
Well, Dmanisi is in the mountains of Georgia, and that's not the state of Georgia in the U.S. It's the Republic of Georgia, which is right by Armenia and, you know, Ukraine and Turkey. It's nestled into that spot between the Black and Caspian Seas in Europe.
And some hominid fossils were found there, and you know, people find them here and there around the world. What is special? What's weird about the fossils that were found there?
Well, there's a lot of things that are special and a lot of things that are really weird about these fossils. And, you know, they've been finding them there for more than 20 years, which that in itself is pretty exciting because most of the time, hominid sites, they're so scattered and you find maybe a piece of skull here and a femur there, but they're finding multiple fossils. So that in and of itself is really interesting. But the other part of it is they don't know what the fossils belong to, what species, and even more interesting, they can't explain what they're doing there so early in the fossil record. They are in Europe about 1.8 million years ago, which is way earlier than we would expect to find hominid fossils in that area.
And it sounds like scientists are scratching their heads because they expected there to be some sort of evidence of sophisticated tools or some other sort of big advantage that would enable these people to be over there, but there wasn't.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing, the researchers I talked to, they all stress that these folks, as far as we know, in the fossil record, these were the first members of the genus Homo to experience seasonality, to experience not like super cold winters like Wisconsin has, but, you know, they had times when there was no fruit on the tree for them to eat, and they had times when they had to figure out, you know, how to keep warm. And apparently, they got to Georgia and were dealing with winters all without either mastering fire or having advanced stone tools that could help them do things, you know, like make clothing and such. Well, not clothing, but, you know, wear skins better and stuff. And so it's a really interesting question because they're very primitive, both in apparently what they had in terms of technology and the size of their brain case. But from the neck down, they are very, very close to Homo erectus, which is kind of the, you know, a couple steps up our family tree. It's pretty close to modern humans. And, you know, they're here in Georgia, like thousands, hundreds of thousands of years before we would expect to find them. So how did they get there and what were they doing there? That's what I want to know.
Now, there were other fossils found there, too, as I understand, non-human ones, but things that might eat humans, say.
Yeah, in fact, and you know, when you see photos of the excavation site, it's a little bit larger than like the average American living room, I think, and they found 10,000 bones
wow.
there. Yeah, from 50 other species, you've got deer and bears and saber-toothed tigers, and my personal favorite, the Panthera gombazogensis, I'm probably saying that wrong, but it is a European jaguar the size of a lion. Okay.
Wow.
Think
wow.
about that. And then you've got these poor little hominids in the middle of all this with, you know, a couple really basic stone tools. So it's probably no surprise that the hominids were eaten quite a bit. They were prey, but they were also predator. We're finding evidence that they were hunting or at least scavenging and maybe occasionally, you know, hitting a deer with a rock just right and taking it home for dinner. But it's incredible biodiversity at that site, and they think it's because of the location. It's where two rivers meet. It's a really rich area in terms of vegetation and such. And, you know, it was one of the researchers I talked to said it was a good place to die because, it was, you know, there was water, there was food, and there was a lot of things to eat or get eaten by.
Now, so before we leave this, what is the next step in trying to figure out what all of these fossil finds mean?
Well, they're still digging, and that is maybe the most tantalizing part of the story because they dug a few test holes last summer, and they're going to go back this summer, but every test hole they dug outside the initial excavation area had additional fossils in it. So this area, we're just beginning to really appreciate the richness in terms of fossils for this area. It's super exciting.
It's going to be a fun one to watch. I wanted to touch on one more feature in this month's magazine, 20 Things We Didn't Know About Dust. What's so cool about dust, Gemma?
Okay, so we think about dust like as proof that we don't clean the house as often as we should. But there are so many amazing things about dust. I'll just give you my absolute favorite. There is a place in the southern Sahara Desert. It's an enormous ancient lake bed. It's called the Bodoli Depression. And it is the greatest single source of dust in the world. And dust from that southern Sahara site blows across the Atlantic Ocean to South America, where the iron and phosphorus it contains actually fertilizes the nutrient-poor soil of the Amazon rainforest. How crazy is that?
Wow.
Wow. So dust really gets around.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including cosmic dust, space dust, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one of the cool things we mentioned in the story is you, too, can see cosmic dust in the zodiacal light, which is a glow that's visible from Earth that comes from the particles scattering sunlight. And if you look in the western sky, just after sunset, or in the east before dawn, and, you know, sometimes you see that light that looks like a city, maybe just beyond the horizon, that's actually cosmic dust. It's, as our writer very eloquently put it, it is the glow of a perpetually dusty universe.
Wow.
Wow. A lot of stuff to know about dust. Well, Gemma, thanks for all the science wisdom today.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about the latest science news.